Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Menominee Builders organization is working on solutions for safe and stable housing for community members who are struggling. We'll meet two of the organizers of that project. First, have you ever had an experience where you felt like you just didn't fit in? You couldn't figure out the right things to say? You felt like you didn't connect with people? You had trouble making friends or relating to coworkers? Maybe your background or childhood didn't provide you with the cultural references or social rules that everyone else seems to just know. Our next guest grew up trying to come to terms with what she calls her weirdness. Olga Kazan is a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers health and science. I talked to her earlier this year about her book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Olga, welcome back.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me on.
Can you talk a little bit about your personal experience that was a big part of the inspiration for you wanting to pursue this concept of weirdness?
Yeah, I got really interested in what it was like to feel different and kind of the state of difference because of my childhood. I'm a Russian Jewish refugee, and I grew up in Midland, Texas, which is in far west Texas. I was really, for a long time, the only kid like me that was around. Sort of even beyond that kind of initial phase of feeling like an oddball, like in my classes and things like that. It was just sort of a early childhood experience that really stuck with me and kind of permeated a lot of my psychology later on in life. And kind of some of the things that held me back, but also kind of carried me forward. So I really wanted to look into what that was all about and what is it like to be a fish out of water and what's the psychology behind that. So that's when I started reaching out to other people who had different, but similar kind of experiences of being unlike everyone else around them, to kind of learn from them and learn what their experiences were like.
And choosing the word weird as your title, I think ends up fitting really well because it's a double or maybe quadruple edged sword. Some people embrace weird as a positive thing. Some people, I think, recoil from it. And you see that whole range of experiences in the people you talk to.
Yeah, totally. I mean, most of the I talk to people who were, for example, like a male preschool teacher or a liberal living in a really conservative environment or a conservative living in a really liberal environment. Weird is often something that people say in a kind of insulting way toward people they don't agree with or who they think are different. But I was kind of trying to reclaim it and say that, it can actually be a good thing to be weird and that we shouldn't shy away from the label quite so much like we do.
There are downsides, and they're big and small depending on people's experiences. One thing that really struck me, it was a group of, I think, faculty members at a school said, hey, for the next week, we're going to take turns. One of us is going to be ostracized. We're going to pick that one person. They're going to have, I think they actually had a scarlet O, right? And we're going to be mean to them and ignore them and dismiss them. And even though everybody knew it was just kind of an exercise, it felt really terrible. What did you hear from that that intentional experience of weirdness?
Yeah, so this is just a really, I thought, poignant example of how awful ostracism can feel, even in adulthood, and even, in fact, when you're in on what's happening. We often think that, after, middle school or high school, people, feeling like an oddball isn't really like a big deal. But in fact, these researchers found, they would kind of label each one of their offices as with an O for ostracized for that day. And then they would know they were going to be ignored that day, but they were ignored by their colleagues that day. And they felt like it was really hurtful. They wrote things in their journals like, I feel like a ghost on the floor that no one sees. And, they started doing like anything they could imagine to just to get their colleagues to acknowledge them. Like it really struck them that they were being kind of snubbed and ostracized in that way, even though, they knew why it was happening and they knew that it was going to come to an end soon. So that just goes to show how hurtful this kind of experience can be, especially when we're like not invited to a wedding or, a baby shower or something like that. That can actually be a lot more deep and hurtful than, it might seem on its face.
We're talking to Olga Kazan. Her new book is called Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. We'll maybe talk more about the downside of being weird and meet some of the people that, you met in the course of researching this, Olga. But I want to look at some of the upside, too. And you found, as you looked into the research on this, having, say, outsiders, the weird people in a group, on a committee, whatever, could actually lead to better outcomes, better decision-making. What is behind that?
Totally. So this has been a consistent finding in psychology that having someone who is kind of a competing perspective or a minority view on a team can actually help the team make better decisions. They keep you, they help you avoid the sunk cost fallacy, which is this idea that like we should follow through with this bad idea to the end just because we've already started doing it. You know, people are less likely to kind of follow along with groupthink and with obviously bad decisions if there's just one person who's willing to say, hey, wait a second, I don't know about this. You know, that person does risk looking like a outsider or like someone who's unusual, but they actually help the whole team kind of triumph in the end. One quote from the researchers, some of the research that I read was, defiance per se, the explicit flaunting of a majority's claim for truth significantly reduces the grip of conformity on observers, which I thought was a really powerful, you know, defiance per se, you know, testament to the power of weirdos.
And another benefit may come in the form of creativity. How does that work?
Yeah, so this has also been kind of been held up in studies, which is this idea that people who have traveled abroad or in a culture that is not like their own or have even just been rejected socially tend to come up with more creative solutions to problems. And the way they tested this is actually having volunteers come into a lab and then rejecting half of them. So kind of saying like, you guys are not going to work with the group on this one. So they kind of felt like, oh, what did we do? We're kind of like outsiders here. And then they would have everyone draw these aliens. They were supposed to be from a planet very unlike our own. And it turned out that the people who were rejected actually drew more creative looking aliens than the people who were included, because they sort of felt like, you know, I am already not part of this group. I already don't have to impress them. You know, I don't need to follow any rules. I can just kind of throw spaghetti at the wall and come up with whatever. So it kind of just shows you how, even though it might not be necessarily fun to be kind of the odd one out, it can definitely let those brain juices flow and help you come up with creative ideas.
That's drawing Martians in this lab experiment. Do you see that playing out kind of in the real world, you and or the many people you talk to who were in one way or another outsiders harnessing that that for creativity?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been like definitely smaller level things where I have, you know, like come up with creative ideas. And, you know, I can never be sure if it's because I had this weird background or because just of something else. There are a few interesting examples from history, Nabokov wrote Lolita when he was traveling, and Picasso started experimenting with cubism when he was living abroad. Not in his native culture. So there is kind of this benefit to kind of being a fish out of water that can help you kind of come up with new ideas. And that's definitely something I saw in the people that I interviewed too.
We're talking with Olga Kazan about her book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Olga Kazan. We're talking about her book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Olga, I want to talk some about strategies that different people have adopted in this situation of being an outsider, being seen as weird. And one is kind of a power through strategy. And I hope you could share the story of this doctor. He's now at Johns Hopkins University. And he was looked at when he was applying to medical schools as not a likely prospect. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, I was just so inspired by this guy's persistence and perseverance. This is Michael Ain. He's a surgeon, and he has short stature. He has dwarfism. So when he was applying to medical school, it was still kind of an era where there was this expectation that doctors would look a certain way and act a certain way. Really the fact that he was short was holding him back. People were outright saying, you know, patients won't respect you. You know, they want tall, imposing doctors. And so he was rejected from something like 30 medical schools. And he just kept going. He applied to the 31st after he was, you know, rejected from 30. And the same thing happened when he started applying to surgery programs too. And I was just so kind of, inspired by him because I don't know that many people who would, you know, not be discouraged by that or take it as a sign that they weren't going to make it, and instead just be even more motivated to break through. And so I kind of started the book with him because I just remembered talking to him and was like blown away by his spirit. And he actually ended up making it to Johns Hopkins, which is of course one of the best hospitals in the country, and became like a renowned surgeon who actually helps kids of short stature and helps them with their spinal and kind of bone issues. So he kind of came full circle and ended up helping other people like him.
Another strategy you talk about is, you know, finding similar people when that's possible, finding people in your situation. What kind of stories did you encounter along those lines?
Yeah. So, you know, I really just found that even though, you know, by their nature, these folks are living or working in situations where there's not going to be a lot of other people doing their same thing. But what they do is they kind of build communities of supporters around them. So in the case of Julia Landauer, this really great NASCAR driver that I followed for a while, she really has a really supportive family, not necessarily like financially. You know, she still has to hustle and get out there and raise money for her own racing, but her family is just very morally supportive. They come to a lot of her races. They help her with coaching and like kind of give her tips and strategies and feedback on how she's doing. So I felt like she really had this like crew of people who are like rallying around her and like helping her out. And so she kind of, I feel like that kind of helped her weather this really tough profession, not just for the racing, but just like the financials of NASCAR are really hard to make work apparently. I was really impressed by her ability to do that. And then, you know, the other thing I noticed is just like people who would find friends who are really supportive of their decisions. I interviewed this one, they're called, Choice Moms. It's like women who, have a baby on their own without getting married first. So they'll just have a sperm donor and have a baby that way. That's like a decision that is often like frowned upon in some cultures. But this woman who had a really great experience doing that actually, you know, had her friends over and they all picked the sperm donor together. And it was like this big party and they all celebrated it. And, you know, like her whole like community was like, yay, you. And that definitely makes it easier to make those kinds of decisions when you have that kind of community.
Let's bring on our callers now. Julia is with us in Heartland. Julia, hi.
Hi, hello.
Hi, what'd you want to tell us about Julia?
So just as part of, I guess, my destined path that I just decided very early on in high school was that I was going to get into metal fabrication and welding, which is definitely not something that is meant for, you know, women. And it's definitely a weird path that people just decide very early on. And I definitely got some flack for it in the beginning of my path on going into being a fabricator. I definitely got some men who were definitely trying to show me up. But it was definitely one of the best decisions I've made, even though it wasn't a traditional path for somebody like myself. And I've definitely been able to make these incredible things and teach other people and just get them also inspired to join like the fabrication and manufacturing field. And it's definitely something that was so worth going into something that was just untraditional.
And Julia, let me ask you, was there something you think that helped you get through those earlier stages when you were facing that, you know, the rejection, the men, as you said, trying to show you up and that got you to where you are now?
I think just the challenge of it and just being told, like, you're not really going to make it. Like, you can't really lift steel. You can't really weld as good as I can. And just that challenge of, yeah, you think this, but let me show you that you're wrong, was really what kind of pushed me to just be better than where I started.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Julia. Olga, what do you think?
Yeah, she reminds me a lot of this woman, Michelle, who I interviewed, who became one of the only African-American female law partners. There's like very few of those, and then actually then became head of the NBA Players Association. But she, her whole life was told, you know, you're never going to make it. You're not good enough, because she was this very high achieving African-American woman from a poor neighborhood. And she was just completely driven to show up her haters and to show how awesome she was and to like blow everyone out of the water and to, have everyone's jaw drop after she kind of shows them up. So that can definitely be a huge motivator, is this desire to be better than the people who doubt you.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Julia. We'll go to Lenny now in McFarland. Lenny, hello.
Hello. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and went to a really good, one of the 10 best high schools in the country at that time. And then I went for my sophomore year to Purdue, where I had terrible culture shock. And the girls I was with initially thought I was weird, and I thought they were dumb. And I enjoyed when they needed me to tutor them. Making remarks that I have reduced this concept to its irreducible minimum. I don't see what you can't see.
Letty, thanks for calling in. Are there ways you can see, Olga, that we can, reach across that mutual sense of weirdness when we're in a new place?
Yeah. I definitely think that so this is something that one of the psychologists that I interviewed mentioned, is that if you go into a situation anticipating that people will like you and that they'll have a good reaction to you, that can actually help kind of generally improve the nature of the interaction. Like, it's a little bit of a subconscious, like people can kind of tell when you look like you think that they're not going to like you. So, you know, if you just go in kind of expecting the best and expecting things to go well, then they generally will. So I think that might be one strategy, is just to realize, hey, you know, I'm a little unusual here. I'm not from around here, but, we are going to find something that we have in common, and I'm going to, you know, have a fine time here. Could be just a good mindset to try to rehearse, even though it's, can be difficult at times, I realize.
Do you have thoughts for the non-weird part, the insiders, to check themselves and think about how they react to the outsider in their midst?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think like, and it's been a good thing, you know, society has gotten more open-minded, I think, in the past few years. And like, even one of the people that I interviewed, she was this sociology professor who was fairly liberal, living in the most conservative congressional district in the country. And she found that it became kind of easier to interact with, and you know, students knew more about some of the subject matter she was teaching, just because society's become more open and accepting. So students would know about things like the glass ceiling, or they'd be familiar with the concept of feminism, or, you know, they'd be familiar with the concept of gender identity going into the semester. That wasn't necessarily something she had to like introduce for the first time, whereas, you know, maybe 10 or 20 years ago it would have been. So I think in general, society's becoming more open, which is definitely making it easier on all the weirdos out there.
We'll go back to your calls. Rana is with us in Cameron. Rana, hello.
Hello, Rob. After I graduated from college, I with a degree in meat animal science, I wasn't able to find a woman at that time. But anyway, I was hired by Farm and Fleet, and I became one of the, I was the first woman in their management training program. And that was a bit of a strange experience, because there was no one around that looked like me. After I worked there, I went into back to school and got my teaching degree in ag education. And again, this a similar experience. I was one of the only females back in the day teaching ag education, and also shop classes such as welding and construction. And so anyway, I always kind of felt like an outsider, kind of a weirdo, I guess. There's always going to be people that want to work with you because they want to be successful. And if you want to be successful, that'll show in your actions and your comments and your leadership that you bring to wherever you are. And so then you work with the people that want to be there, that want to work with you, and the others, they're just missing out on a great opportunity.
All right, Rana, thank you so much. And Olga, that reminds me of a category in your book, and a couple of our callers and people you've mentioned fit this category, the trailblazers, the people who are willing to be that first odd one out, and maybe other people follow suit later.
Yes, and the cutest example of this was the first people to try online dating. Of course, now we think that it's so common and that anyone would do it, and we're all meeting on OkCupid or Tinder or whatever it is. But when it first started, this was considered like something you would only do if no one, you know, you couldn't find anyone any other way. And so these people were getting on Match.com in, you know, the late 90s and sending each other emails, and like they couldn't actually send each other photos of themselves because internet connections were not strong enough to upload a photo at the time. So they were sending each other photos like through the post, like through the mail. And, you know, all their relatives thought, you know, that they were going to get axe murdered the second they met up. But they're both still married and they're very happy. And I think that kind of feeling of being kind of an innovator and a trailblazer and willing to do something a little unusual is actually like something that kind of attracts them to one another. Like it seems like they kind of like that about each other, that they were willing to kind of go out on a limb.
Wasn't it they were both willing to meet somebody within a 500-mile range, and they did the math and they lived 499 miles apart?
Yes, I thought that was the craziest. That just so happened. Like, they didn't even realize that they lived that far away from each other at the time. So, yeah, it was lucky for them.
We're talking with Olga Kazan about her book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers health and science. We'll listen back to the rest of our chat after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. Stay with us here on Central Talk. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Olga Kazan about her book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. And we want to hear from you. Are we talking about your life? Have you felt weird, like an outsider at some point, at school, at work, when you move to a new place? Tell us about it. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's at Central Time WPR on Twitter. I want to visit one story you tell from here in Wisconsin, where a county that a lot of people around the country paid attention to because it was a big swing county in votes, Trumbull County. Can you talk about what you learned when you talked to a Mexican immigrant named Gloria that you interviewed?
Yeah, so I interviewed a few individuals in that county who had immigrated, and I just want to say they all said they had, you know, built a good life there. For the most part, people were very accepting, but it just kind of spoke to some of the tensions that that people feel whenever they're an immigrant or an outsider, because it seemed like when they first got there, they were sort of kept at arm's length, not like fully integrated because they didn't necessarily speak the language or whatever else, you know, but ultimately they were able to be accepted. But then there got to be more and more immigrants in that area. And there was sort of an influx because of some things that changed in the economy and with immigration patterns. And then there was actually a little bit of a backlash to immigration there. And you know, there was kind of this local sentiment that, well, now we have too many immigrants and we need to do something about that. So actually, after voting for Obama twice, that county went for Trump in 2016, in part because, you know, political researchers think there was this sort of backlash to the wave of immigrants. So I talked to some of the immigrants who were part of that wave and sort of how they experienced that.
Now, you look at some of the sociology when it comes to conformity or acceptance of difference, and there's a real continuum from one society to another or one community to another. And made me think we've got kind of a two-pronged thing going on here in American culture where so many of our pop culture heroes are, you know, the outsiders, the rebels, the bold thinkers who get things done. And yet we've got a pretty heavy conformist streak mixed in there at the same time. Is that weird here in the United States or I don't know. I guess you'd need a huge international study, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So the difference you're describing is between tight and loose cultures. So tight cultures are those that have a lot of rules and a lot of they have a lot of conformity. There's like a certain way to do everything, a certain way to dress, a certain way to behave. If you think about religions like the Amish, that's a tight culture. They kind of mandate everything you're going to do your whole life. A loose culture is like Burning Man, right? It's like, do whatever you want. There's no rules. You can dress however, you can, you know, do whatever. So I think different parts of America are different kind of levels of tight and loose. I think a lot of the kind of renegade heroes that we have come up in Silicon Valley, which I think is like a pretty loose culture. It's startups are a very loose culture, and it's just full of startups and technology companies, which just tend to be more freer to those kinds of like creative types. So even if you're like the CEO who screams at everyone and wears the same thing every day and like, you know, whatever else you're going to do that's like really unusual, that's going to be more accepted in that loose culture because, you know, that there already aren't a lot of rules that you have to follow. So I think that might be part of what you're seeing there.
I want to wrap up looking at the unwritten rules that can make it hard for that outsider to figure out how to fit in. And you write about your own experience with this, I think, in college, you know, not being part of the high school culture in the past. You didn't know, for example, the rule for how to end a conversation. Could you talk about how hard it is for that outsider to suss out the rules that everybody else knows but can't necessarily even explain?
Yeah, I mean, that was like an extreme experience of mine. Like, I just didn't have a lot of, my parents never had anyone over, and I never had really like formal conversations before I went to college. You know, I think day to day, people experience this with office dress codes or office, you know, speech or office. I remember, so I used to work at the Washington Post, and one of my first days, I went to this meeting, and I sat in like the wrong chair at the the meeting, and I sat in this chair that was really important for someone like really high up. And you know, it's just like all those little subtle things that you don't realize but that everyone else realizes you know, you don't necessarily pick up on, but you know, there's like so many of these subtle rules, just like RSVPing to a wedding and what do you wear to a wedding, and you know, what do you do when someone says this or that, or what do you say when your boss asks you to do something? Like there's just a million ways that we kind of these codes that we follow in order to make everyone around us more comfortable. And for people who are weird, those codes can be really difficult to learn.
Olga will end the conversation with me thanking you for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on.
That was Olga Kazan. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers health and science. We talked with her about her book, Weird, The Power of Being an Outsider in an Insider World. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum talking with the author of a critically acclaimed collection of essays that was released this summer. It explores Midwestern complexities like gender and softball.
Even though 2020 has been a year, Melissa Falavino has had some bright spots this summer. The New York City writer released her debut essay collection, Tomboyland. It's a deep dive into identity, zeroing in on gender and sexuality. Falavino's complexities unfold as she explores her life growing up in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, digging into her love of meatballs and softballs, moths and tornadoes. Another bright spot of the summer? It was when we talked during her visit to Madison.
Oh my God, we are in my absolute favorite place on the planet, which is at Olbrich Park, sitting in center field in Packer chairs that Maureen brought. It is actually a perfect day.
It really is. Falavino and I met at the Ulbrich Park softball fields mostly because of the pandemic, but also because she writes about the sport's impact on her in Tomboyland. Here's an excerpt from the essay, Switch Hitter.
In the Midwest, softball is something of a hallowed thing for girls. Here in America's heartland, where so many girls are born and raised by generations of farm families, their bodies built for baling hay, their shoulders broad, their backs and hands strong, their muscles long and lean. Like they were born to play ball. Like they came out of the womb with gloves on their hands, cleats already digging into the dirt. Growing up in a small town where boys were boys and girls were girls, playing softball also meant being called a lesbian. This was the worst possible insult, one we worked hard to combat. It meant applying too much makeup, even and perhaps especially before games, making sure our hair was just right, straightened and sprayed at lockers between class, wearing short skirts and high heels and low-cut shirts on game days. All this to assure the boys and the men that even though we played softball, we were still girls, that we were sexy, available, and straight, that our bodies were objects for them to desire.
Can you explain why you decided to write that section?
Yeah, I mean, I knew that I wanted to write about softball because it was such an important part of my life, and I knew it was complex.
You were a big deal in the Mount Horeb world of softball.
In the world of small-town sports, I guess I was something of a big deal. You know, it was my life, and it was my plan, and I was going to go play D1 softball at UW, and I got close, and then totally failed, and the whole trajectory of my life changed. You know, everything that I sort of expected I was going to do and be didn't happen, and I took this totally different route and became a writer. And that there's still some grief, though, you know, like, and I grieve that life, that playing the sport competitively like that, what that did for me as a kid. And so I knew that I wanted to write about that. But then I was like, oh, there's so much more here. So I get into the ways that we as girls, when we're young, we learn to perform under the male gaze. And even if it's not told to us explicitly, we learn it implicitly. And like everything that we do, maybe especially in a small town, about being desired and being attractive and being popular and being objects for boys and, you know, sometimes even adult men to want. And it's a pretty vulnerable piece. And there's a lot of things that I still am like freaked out to have in the world. And there are days when I'm like, why would I do that? Why would I write that? But the cool thing has been having predominantly women, a lot of queer women, you know, writing me and saying like, oh man, I identified so hard with this. And like, I feel like you were writing my story, and it's such a ubiquitous thing, girls playing sports, you know, but there's so much complexity there, especially within the realm of identity and the body and desire. So
that was Melissa Falavino, author of the new essay collection, Tomboyland. She's a Mount Horeb native who now writes, teaches, and plays music in New York City. Want to hear a longer conversation with Falavino? Tune in to Beta on WPR, where we talk about empathizing with moths and what it means to turn your body into a machine. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll learn about a project to build tiny houses on the Menominee Reservation to address a housing shortage for tribal members. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, on the Menominee Reservation, community organizers are hoping tiny homes have a big impact. The group Menikonicum, or Menominee Rebuilders, aims to help community members who are struggling by providing safe and stable housing while they get the help they need. Anaquet is the executive director of Menominee Rebuilders. He's a traditional Menominee who lives on the Menominee Reservation. Anaquet, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, post welcome.
And Kristen Welch of the Menominee Nation is with us. She's lead organizer for the Menominee Rebuilders Women's Leadership Cohort for Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women. Kristen, welcome to Central Time.
Poso, thank you for having me.
Anaquet, can you start off by telling us a little bit about this Tiny Homes project?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Tiny Home project began many years ago here on the reservation. We've always kind of had the idea of how our community has been struggling with housing. We have 9,000 enrolled members, about 3,000 live here on the reservation. So we've kicked around ideas for a long time, thinking about how we could approach that. When I started to do some work on doing some community organizing, I did some one-on-ones with a lot of our elders, a lot of our older community members, and they really painted a beautiful picture of home ownership and what our community used to look like when everybody owned their own homes. And it was something that was like, you know, old, but I was something new I heard, and we thought, man, we got to do something. So the tiny homes was always a big part of that. And we also wanted to reimagine and dream a little bit about what our communities could look like if we were never contacted by Europeans. So we wanted to put our tiny home village together in that sort of mind frame.
And before we dig into what the village will look like, Kristen, can you tell us a little bit about who these homes are intended to provide a home for?
Sure. We wanted to make sure that who was able to come into those homes was open to as many of our community members as possible. So we didn't put a whole lot of restriction on it, just that you had to be looking towards that place of healing or recovery. And that can be anyone from our domestic violence and sexual assault survivors to those transitioning out of detention. A lot of people need emergency housing, especially with COVID. And we do have a lot of young people that transition from home to home in need of spaces too. So we wanted to make sure that it was able to serve anyone in need of a safe place to stay.
Anaquet, can you paint us a picture of what one of these homes will look like?
Well, I mean, there's a couple different ideas going around. I don't think we've necessarily settled on a design yet. But we wanted something to mirror our traditional homes that we used to live in, you know, hundreds of years ago. There's a couple different styles that we thought. The wigwam, of course, was a style that came right up to the top. But also we wanted to focus a little bit on our medicine lodge, which is a little bit longer of a lodge. It's almost like a longhouse, if that makes any sense to people. We wanted to do something like that. So we obviously recognize right away that people that be living in our homes are going to be, you know, have family, have children, have other people with them, and they're most likely not going to be single residents, although there are some.
And Kristen, that sounds like, from what Anaquet was saying, you know, we've seen tiny houses in cities that look like smaller versions of city houses. This sounds like a project that's trying to make it, I guess, fit in culturally. Is that right?
Yeah, and I would say not even make it fit, but be founded. Like, that's the foundation of what the house looks like, what the community members who stay in the houses have access to. The whole process is really decolonizing the way that we look at housing and how we support our community members.
Anaquet, can you talk a little more about that, how this isn't just a structure, but a connection to the community?
Well, you know, if you got time, I have about a 3-hour story to tell. But this actually is very much that. It comes from, you know, thousands of years ago when that original structure was given to us. So it has a beautiful story. It talks about us as a people, talks about, you know, our culture, our language. It has all those things within it, and it's very deeply connected to who we are and to our identity as Menominees. So we wanted to definitely have that as the foundation in which we started to build.
And Kristen, I've heard of the idea of kind of an intergenerational trauma being something that First Nations and Native communities are dealing with. That is this one maybe small piece of trying to heal that?
Yeah, and I think it recognizes not just the intergenerational trauma, but the intergenerational resilience of our community members, and that being the foundation of how we move and heal and build structure and community again. So it's pulling those strengths back and bringing them to this present time.
We're talking to Kristen Welch and Aniquette, both with the Menominee Nation, talking about a rebuilding program aiming to provide small houses on the reservation and community connections along the way. Aniquette, on a practical level, where are you now and what's going to take to get from where you are to having some of these houses up and ready to roll?
Yeah, so we have one built right now. We do have a resident in that building right now. This first one was kind of just a test run for us to see what kind of materials it would take, how much it would cost, and how quickly we could put something together. But we have gotten a grant to build a couple more. So we're planning right now on thinking how that's going to look during this COVID time and how we can get that done. But the second homes are definitely going to have a little bit more planning and a lot more cultural thought behind it compared to the first one. So we've always are looking, hopefully this COVID, we can find ways to work around it and get our community more involved. But at this point, it's probably going to be a lot smaller of building and constructing.
Kristen, what kind of response have you gotten from your community?
I think there's a lot of hope around it. I know that we have family members that are engaged in MMIW that are really supporting the idea. We also have a lot of agencies that have helped to kind of construct the idea of what the tiny homes look like and bringing it together. So there's definitely community support there. And we even have some community members that are doing personal fundraising to help build more homes.
Aniquette, I saw on the website you are doing some fundraising outreach to get this going. What kind of things are happening?
Yeah, so last year we came up with an idea to do a fun run walk around our property. We have like an 80-acre farm located on the Menominee Indian Reservation. So this year, because of course, the time in which we're in, we couldn't have a big group of people running around. So we did something digitally where people would be able to like clock in their time and post to our Facebook page and track the miles that they put on. And I think, you know, just being as a nonprofit, we're always looking for donations.
And Kristen, you mentioned not enough room for all the people of the Menominee Nation to live there. Is it your hope that this is going to give more people the option to live in the community?
Yeah, of course. We wanted to expand. I know the dream was that, you know, we would have multiple pods of these tiny homes out at Minneconicum, but that even that vision could grow into something like bigger actual housing within our community that's sustainable and developed by the community.
And Aniquette, is there a hope that, the residents then who move into these houses are going to be part of, I guess, the future of the project and pass on to the next round of people who move in?
Yeah, we're hoping that they, get what it is they're looking for and that they're inspired to invest back in our community. And I think, the biggest thing that we're trying to do is to instill some hope, belonging, meaning, and purpose. Hopefully that these residents will be able to grab that and carry that forward into the future.
Well, looking forward maybe a year or so, Kristen, what is your hope for where this project is at by that point?
Well, we definitely hope to see some of the tiny home residents have graduated from the transitional living space and, like Aniquette said, have now come back as mentors in the program, and they're able to help that next generation of tiny home residents through the process, but that they can expand that out into the community work as well.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Aniquette, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, why not?
That's Kristen Welch and Aniquette from Menicanicum, Menominee Rebuilders. We talked with them today about a tiny home building project their organization is working on to provide safe and stable housing to community members of Menominee Nation. . 2020 was a weird year for news, not just the big stories like the presidential race and the pandemic. It also brought us headlines about murder hornets, weird monoliths, and collapsing telescopes. But it could have been way weirder, according to some headlines written using neural networks. Janelle Shane is an artificial intelligence researcher. She was on the show earlier this year to talk about her book, You Look Like a Thing and I Love You. In one of her latest projects, she trained a neural network using the headlines of the last couple years to come up with some of the weird news that wasn't. Here are some of the headlines from that project, again, in case you're just tuning in, not real news. When killer orchids attack, how the deadly corpse orchid is turning up in U.S. backyards. Mysterious origin of monster deep sea toads solved. NASA, has Earth halted and stopped spinning? If what NASA states is true, we must all celebrate. Now. Why scientists believe the killer raccoons of the Pacific Northwest are responsible for this kill? What are dragon cats, and why are they getting hyped? And scorpions on the dark side of the moon. Again, all fictional 2020 headlines created in an artificial intelligence project. But who knows what's in the works for 2021? This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.